I am Drew. Hello.
I am Chris. Hello.
I am Matt. Hello.
I am Stacy. Hello.
Awesome. I'll cut that in at the beginning. So we watched episode one of The West Wing, pilot. I guess, first of all, so I've seen the West Wing many, many times. I've watched all of The West Wing many, 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 many times. I believe Stacy is partway through watching it.
I'm almost to season three.
Right. And Chris and Matt have both not seen it before, right?
Yes. Not seen it before. Watched episode one, Mr. Pilot.
Sorry, you missed the pilot?
No, Mr. Pilot.
Mr. Pilot?
The episode, no, Mr. Pilot.
You're calling it Mr. Pilot.
Okay. What about Captain? Mr. Captain.
Pilot?
How did you do that?
We watched Mr. Pilot. So, first of all, what did you think of it?
It's of its time. It's 1999.
Yeah.
So heavy-handed on the music. I know it's a superficial thing, but it was one of those things that it did sort of... That's also very piloty, though, isn't it? So I don't know, maybe it does or doesn't carry on through. I'm undecided about whether or not I like it, because a lot of the characters, they seem very caricatype-y of a lot of, like... that people from that time, like a lot, like there are a lot of that kind of dialogue. You've seen it in a lot of stuff, like films and stuff.
Like, I mean, that's that kind like of dialogue,
sarcastic, snarky,
that dialogue, like fast talking smart people dialogue, that's Sorkin's like whole deal. So if you don't like that's that
Sorkin's whole thing, yeah,
you're in for some punishment.
The question I have is, are we supposed to like these people? Are they supposed to be likable people?
Yeah
Some of them.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you've got to bear in mind this is the. I mean, pilots. The way that I mean, pilots are written over like a period of weeks or months, right? Whereas the episodes when they come out, like, very different. So a lot more went into this. Also, it's introducing the characters. I think like the opening vignettes where you get like.
That's what all pilots are, though. Just like showing you who these people are, and then the story will carry after that.
Yeah,
There's a lot that happens in this episode.
Well, so I think it's mostly introducing you to the characters. I think it does a really good job. Like the little vignettes at the start, like they're really nice. You get to see like you get a glimpse into their characters of each one.
Yeah, it's interesting that they laid the groundwork before Martin Sheen came on. I don't know how much Martin Sheen like. I knew he was. I'm sure. Like I knew there was going to be some kind of unveiling. I didn't know it was Martin Sheen. I know very little about The West Wing.
Same.
I think I've seen like memes and you know various bits and pieces. So I wasn't like knocked off my chair. Oh, Martin Sheen! Massive surprise. Like he's very like yes, expected some. You know, like you'd expect someone like Martin Sheen to have that role, but. But yeah, no, it's interesting. So they laid the foundation. So it'd be interesting. They didn't really cover much to do with Martin Sheen. And
well, the original idea for the show was that the president was not a recurring character, not a regular character. The president was not supposed to be in it as much as he ended up being, or at least that's what they say about it. It was supposed to be about the people working in the West Wing, not the president. But people enjoyed. Sheen's performance of the president so much that he's in it more than they intended. And honestly, I think I enjoy Martin Sheen's a great actor. He plays that character excellently, but I think it probably would have been a better show if it had concentrated more on the West Wing and less on the president.
Interesting.
It makes sense that he's in the scene that he's in, because showing like how the characters respect him and what he does at the end and how that sort of just appeared like a normal day for him. Like he left it was like, okay, what else is on the schedule for today, right? It's like he knows what is going down and how to handle it, and how to be honest about the fact that he was angry when he rode his bicycle.
He has I mean the best introductory line. I am the Lord your God. Like you can't enter a show with a better line than that.
He's done that. He knows his stuff. You know, they're like arguing over what the commandment is. They don't even know what the commandment is.
That's silly, though. I mean, it sets up the cool line, but the idea that, you know, a prominent right-wing evangelical Christian wouldn't know the order of the commandments. Right, like, I don't buy that, but it's setting up the line. It's fine.
That's political satire, isn't it? Like, it's making fun of the fact that, you know, there are a lot of, like, of, should we say, people of your gun-toting, Bible-holding persuasion that may very well make a big deal about that being part of their identity, but actually it's just, you know.
I think it's I get you, but I think it's satirizing the wrong thing. Like, also the so there's the evil evangelical Christians come to the White House, and then there's one good one that Leo's talking to earlier, right? And it, you know, it's like, don't lump me together with these. The idea that there's, you know, a right-wing evangelical Christian who's a goodie. there's no good right-wing evangelical Christians. He's the one we're friends with.
But I can see why you thought a look back on the West Wing would be an interesting idea, because like I don't know how much that perspective would have been different in 1999, which is what I believe the year came out. So that would be like the last year of Clinton, right?
A few more years left. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it's the year of Clinton's impeachment hearings,
right? Yeah,
which is interesting.
So is Martin Sheen like a Clinton-esque neoliberal?
I don't think he's meant to be like based off of Clinton himself. I think he's got Christian values, but with a democratic view of it.
He's definitely
Clinton.
Sorry, he's definitely, he's a 90s Democrat. He's a third way, Clinton-esque, Blair-esque, third way Democrat who's completely capitulated to the right on economics. Like, I mean, this will be more evident throughout the show. Like, on economic issues, they are on the right, you know, in American terms. On social issues, you know, left when they can do it without making the press dislike them. It's very conciliatory, very like it's a left,
yeah,
an American left in retreat and giving way to the right, I think. And this is why I think it's interesting to look back on it. It's the left, or it's the liberal left, that paves the way for Trump. Absolutely.
You didn't hide the moral of that story behind anything, did you?
I mean, that's
said it, yeah, like, I mean, they were words.
That's what, yeah, that's my view of it. But I think,
I mean, like,
go on.
It feels a little bit like that era of political leaders, your New Labour, your Clinton Democrat, feels a little bit like the president being a bit of a TV show guest type of thing coming in now. There was a little, they like not quite as show busy as maybe more recent years, but it was like. The coming in of like the television president type of thing, or has that been around for a long time since then?
I think it's been around a little bit, but what this is probably what you're talking about is like this is the era where liberals, or you know, Labour Party in the UK, like it's all about message. They believe politics is all, and that's where you get that the Ed Miliband clip where he just keeps, he's in an interview and he just keeps repeating the soundbite and he looks absurd, just the sound, like, yeah, no matter what the question, just repeating the soundbite. It's that era of politics, so like stay on message. There's one, like the media, people are idiots, the media's on, you know, only going to pay attention if you just say one thing and say it over and over and over again. It's that very tight control of the message and that mediatized politics. Yeah, which I think people have, that's part of, again, I think why Trump is popular, because he's very much not that.
Yeah. See, that's, yeah. So it is kind of interesting to see, because I don't know if that kind of way would necessarily be as, like, I feel like today we're all more cynical. It felt like there was also a lot of, like, around this time, a lot of, like, what you might think of as bipartisan comedy shows. King of the Hill being like, they say, one of the ones the best shows this off. Like, and it does seem like there's a little bit of like, that's the moment before you either make content that sits to one side of the culture war or the other, right?
Well, no, I get what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, King of the Hill, yeah, he was. Mm. It, like, Hank Hill in his heart is a Democrat who votes Republican, right? But I think what characterizes like present day political stuff is it's cynical about the process, not necessarily polarized in terms of its views, but it sees the whole process as like, I mean, Trump's going to come into this a lot, but you can't really be that optimistic about the presidency anymore. You know, as an institution.
See, but Bartlett, his character, made me very optimistic about like his fake presidency. Like, I think I told you one of my most popular TikToks is when I watched the pilot of The West Wing, and I was like, I will follow that man to the end of the earth. Like, he has my vote all the time.
That's interesting, because you see very little of him in the first episode.
The first episode, but the moment that like he just popped in and told those people off, I was like, hell yeah, get it. And then just went about his day. I was like, I will follow that man anywhere. And I see why his staff loves him so much.
Yeah.
Because he's charismatic. He's not a jerk. Like, not really. Like, there's points in future, which is kind of a butt. But it's kind of everything that president could be if they tried. Like, I would say, like, the closest to a president that I've voted for that I would follow forever would have been Obama.
Yeah, no,
so
yeah.
It's kind of like that, very, like the charismatic, like, I will stand by that man forever, you know?
There were people working in the Obama West Wing who talked about the West Wing, the TV show, as like an inspiration for them, you know, like getting into politics and see the characters in the West Wing as models. So I don't think that's entirely just like a coincidence. Like, obviously, Bartlett wasn't inspired by Obama because he came afterwards, but I think Obama, in some ways, was inspired by the West Wing.
By Bartlett? I mean, that would make sense, because I was very, like, as I told you guys in the text, I was like, this show is going, the first episode is going to make you feel patriotic for a country you two don't live in. And I was like, it's going to be like, yeah, because Bartlett is just great. Like, just that one scene of him telling everyone off.
I mean, solved the situation. He didn't argue. He just solved the situation. He's like, we're going to address we're going to address the fringe group. Shun the non-believers. Get rid of them. Like, we're going to address them. Don't give them attention. And then he's like, I'm out. That's all.
We're done. Yeah.
He's like, just came we're not going to sit here and argue.
Put out the fire, and that was it.
Yeah. But yeah, solve the problem. Move on.
The thesis of the show really is it's an intentionally, like, knowingly optimistic view of politics, right? Even for that, I mean, the 90s was kind of an optimistic time in politics. I think there was a general sense that we were on the right track, you know, and on social issues were definitely going the right way. Economic stuff that's, you know, later turned out to be in question, but there was a feeling of a positivity and optimism. But like, I don't imagine any White House was actually, you know, this good. This nice, but this is Sorkin imagining like an idealized version of a White House that reflects his politics, I would say.
Yeah.
But in the 90s, it was pretty bipartisan, the politics here in the U.S. They were pretty bipartisan. It didn't really start branching off until stuff with George W. Like, I mean, like, people working together to get stuff done in the House and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah,
start breaking off until Bush.
I think, although
the first Bush messed things up too, but people still worked with him.
I think that was a symptom of like post 9/11 things. Post 9/11 is what I think began like the real polarization of not even necessarily in terms of policy, but like the Republicans and Democrats, you know, being seen as like enemies rather than opponents or something like that.
It could be. I mean, maybe switching on the Hadron particle accelerator did something.
You think we split into
didn't that happen around this time?
There's lots of voter suppression. Go on.
But the way Stacey reacted to Bartlett is not so. From what you're saying, Chris, that's not how you received these people and Bartlett. Wow.
I felt that they were very like, and maybe time has tempered this a little bit, but maybe not. But like, it felt very much like a manipulated reaction. You go, oh, we're going to bring in this Democrat strongman character played by, of course, like Martin Sheen, who, you know, he's got the chops for that role. Like, it's a very, you know, like. Easy to do. Give him some pseudo, you know, like talking points that, you know, feel good mantras and stuff like that. Show him to be tough on the bad guys for a little bit, and like it just felt very guided into this. Oh, you're supposed to you're supposed to feel the.
I mean, that is again Sorkin. There's not much. Sorkin is very like a preachy writer. He is just he's writing a lot of characters that are just like smart versions of himself. Like, and he just sets up arguments for him to win. Right. That is. I mean, the style.
This could end up being a show I end up hating, but like,
yeah,
like I enjoy hating it almost. If you know what I mean,
like a hate watch parade.
Like a little, I mean, it deserves a little bit more credit than that. But it's like I don't like, you know, I might not like any of the characters. I might not like the politics that it glamorizes. I might not even like really like a lot of the culture in the late 90s / early 2000s. I don't know. There might be stuff that I roll my eye. I can imagine there being a lot of stuff that I roll my eyes at. It feels very liberal, like very liberally, you know?
Yeah. And it's to put it in a, like in an American sense, liberal is left, right? But in, you know, in a broader sense, they are liberal rather than left. They're not of the left. They are liberal.
Yes. They're like a little bit like don't rock the boat liberal, status quo liberal. We want nice things, but let's do it at a bit by bit.
It's funny that you're getting all this from the pilot, because, yeah, I mean, that's a lot of my frustration with, you know, the politics as it's depicted in the show is their unwillingness to rock the boat to get shit done. Like, you know, there's times when they could do something, you know, really positive, really progressive, but they're like, oh, no, the media won't like it, or the Senate won't like it. We back off from
like,
that.
Yeah, like a gradual way instead of a, like, ambitious...
because it's well, it's like that Martin Luther King letter, isn't it?
Birmingham
where
jail,
where it's like the real yes, it is Birmingham jail letter. Yeah.
Oh, it's I know what you're talking about. It's like outright radicalism is less frustrating than lukewarm acceptance or something like that. Like, yeah, or no, like, more, not mean, frustrating, but more respectful than like lukewarm acceptance and apathy of what's actually happening.
Yeah. It's just basically, it's like
it's Aaron Burr. It's Aaron Burr versus what Hamilton did.
It's like, the thing, it's like the biggest obstacle for civil rights progression is it's the sort of the white liberal that's like both sizing it. You know, like that's the
not to
take a side,
not to get too far down my, you know, personal bias political wormhole, but like every time fascism's emerged, it was liberals who enabled it. Liberals would rather have a fascist than an actual leftist. You know, it's proven recently with, you know, Sanders and Corbyn.
I don't know. That I mean, that's a whole can of worms, and. Because I think a little bit was really like rich people. I think you can have liberals that would slide down the left side of that slope. But the richer you are, the less you're going to want to bring in policies in any way.
I think liberals find leftists upset for reasons I can't quite get my head around. Liberals are more frightened of the left than they are of, you know, the far right. I think maybe because, you know, the left represents a more complete version of what they're representing, and that, you know, that kind of almost embarrasses them. why weren't you doing this?
I feel a little bit of is that liberals are just incrementalists. They're just like the status quo but a little bit better, really. And maybe you might draw privilege into this and thinking that, well, if they're doing all right, then things can't be that bad, but, you know, a little bit better for, you know, a little bit more rights for people down the but only, you know, if everyone's okay with it. We're not, you know,
well, I fundamentally liberals believe in the market as, you know, the governing entity of capital, and leftists don't. That's the fundamental split, and liberals aren't willing to cross that line.
Do you count social democrats as liberals?
They're kind of right on the borderline, right?
That's where one meets t'other, right?
Yeah, the borderlines between social democrats and democratic socialists, right?
Well, I suppose, I mean, if you want to go down by like the EU parliament designation, you've got liberals and social democrats, and then European Free Alliance.
Yeah,
on the left, you know, it goes in that order on the left side, as it were. So, you know, there's a literal. Distinction right there. So, but the social democrats are not like they're not like, for example, on the Nordic Green Left, which is like probably the furthest left group, unless there's something
in mainstream in elected politicians. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, speaking so of like, then, yeah, speaking of lefty things, the representation in the West Wing is terrible.
Yeah, I did notice that. Yeah.
You got like five white men, a white woman.
Yeah.
Later on, they realize we don't have a main black character. Let's get a main black character on. But like, even so, it's and this is you know, it's coming out during the Clinton White House, which was, compared to the West Wing, a relatively diverse White House in terms of people of color and queer people.
Mm. Oops.
Yeah, I think. So go, Stacey. Sorry.
Oh, no, I was saying, oops, indeed.
Yeah, I think, I mean, my read is that's a blind spot for liberals.
Yeah, I suppose.
I think the West Wing is very much like Star Trek in a lot of ways, but particularly in this, you know, it's this humanist liberal idea, you know, idealized idea of how things can be. But then in terms of social progressiveness, representation in that, I mean, in the original Star Trek, you've got Uhura, who is a black woman who's a member of the bridge crew on this very important spaceship, right? That's cool. Yeah. And then her job is to answer the phone. It's like, ah, oh. So close.
Yeah, well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
something
you got. Yeah.
And you've got the male characters, and then you've got CJ, who, like, a big sort of personal plot point for her is, like, inability to do her job and have a man kind of thing, which is very, you know, it's a sexist trope.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, the man in question.
But literally,
related to the job.
that's fair. But her introductory vignette is literally about how hard it is to meet a man and how she's like, you know, this clumsy kind of awkward social person.
Oh god, yeah. That's.
Yeah. I love that's her. Like, I think she's great.
I love her early on. We'll see.
Yeah.
See how it goes later. But she, I mean, in that vignette, she literally face plants.
Mm.
Hard. That was a good stunt.
Hard. Okay, so there's CJ. What did you guys think of Josh?
Josh.
What is your opinion on Josh Lyon, Bradley Whitford's character?
Is he the old hand type of guy? Is he the old hand character? You know,
he's the workaholic.
He's the one. Yeah, he wakes up
at his desk.
He wakes up at his desk. Yeah.
He wakes up at his desk. Yeah. You were in the same suit you wore the previous day.
I love that little bit because they're both wearing the same suit for very different reasons, and that's just left unsaid. And I think that's kind of cute.
Looking him up.
Google him. Google West Wing Josh
to some degree. You know, like they all.
Well, I've got IMDb here.
Chris is going to be like, I don't remember him.
I'm just trying to remember which one.
Yeah, because Josh Lyman's the best. It's Bradley Whitford, the jerk from not Happy Gilmore. It's the other one.
I don't know.
Caddyshack?
Billy Madison.
Oh, right.
There's a lot of walk and talk scenes in this too. There's a lot of like rolling
and that
camera shots.
Aaron Sorkin's the one that did that though. Like that all is from Aaron Sorkin. That's why how it came to be. It's because he's like, you know what? Yeah, we're just gonna follow them with the camera, and they're gonna do their thing.
And this was kind of a turning point in TV. Yeah, there's a ton of stuff that Aaron Sorkin, like, you know, certainly invented but introduced. But this is kind of the era when TV was starting to be like a serious medium for the first time. I think you got TV shows that were you know, considered, you know, artistic works or, you know, something like that, which is fairly new, I think, in the late 90s, early 2000s. I think
family sitcoms, like situational sitcoms that were out in the 90s, and nothing like super
and a lot
serious
of, like,
except for like ER,
police procedurals, and yeah.
Yeah.
I guess I think ER was probably part of that as well. ER was a serious show. I think before that, if you wanted to make worthy TV, you did a miniseries. There weren't many like.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be on network television. It would be on like HBO or Showtime or something like that. Yeah. Like something that not everyone had access to like they do now.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Do you know who Josh is yet, Chris?
Is IMDb helping you enough?
Josh.
So Josh is the one who makes the gaffe. We should probably talk about the plot a little bit. So Josh has been on a TV show with these right-wing evangelicals, and
God tax fraud comment,
which is an awful. It's not a funny line. That's one of the sad things about this episode. If it was a funnier line, you would sympathize way more.
Yeah, it's
the God you pray to is too busy being indicted for tax fraud. It's like, dang.
Jab, jab.
I kind of sympathized with him a little bit on that one, actually. Yeah, like host group. Now, what's his position in the White House again? Is he's not like chief,
he's deputy chief of staff. So Leo McGarry, the older dude, he's chief of staff, which is the closest way,
right? Yeah,
he's the mediator between the president and everybody else. Bradley Whitford, Josh Lyman's job is to like mobilize the forces they need to mobilize to get shit done. You know, the Senate, the House, the media to an extent.
Yeah.
Lobby interest, stuff like that.
What does Toby Ziegler do?
He is a communications director. So he's
communications.
Largely, I think this varies White House to White House, but in the West Wing, he's mainly a speechwriter, policy. What's the word? What's the word for people who talk to the president and influence them? There's a word for that.
Advisor.
Advisor. Yeah, he's an advisor. Policy advisor and speechwriter. I'd say. Yeah.
Okay.
And him and Sam like share that job.
He's the one that points out that anti-Semitism comment, right?
Yeah.
Toby.
Toby.
Yeah. I think Aaron Sorkin's got a good, it's got a good, like, yeah. The fact that there's no representation in this show, and yet he's got such a sharp eye for anti-Semitism, I think speaks to the need for representation, actually. Because Aaron Sorkin was brought up Jewish. Personal experience, he can see that. But, like, the fact that there's not a single black main character bypassed him.
Yeah.
Or people of color in general, you know.
Although that being said, I mean, again, 1999,
yeah,
that's probably like I'm not excusing it by saying it's par for the course, but like if you think about it, like if Friends was made today, it'd be a more diverse cast.
Oh no, for sure, yeah. But when it's giving this like idealized view of liberal blah blah blah, you expect a little bit better of it. I think that's the dissonance.
Maybe. I don't know. It feels a little bit like it's more recent than 99, where we've seen more people of color in White House.
Oh, no, for sure.
You know,
yeah.
Senior White House stuff.
But like, say, the Clinton White House at the time was, you know, very, very, like, you know, it's not like it was, there was no source for this.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's probably a bias on TV, really, I guess. Yeah.
I mean, it's something that to an extent gets corrected later. You get some more kind of rounded women characters, and you get some, I don't want to be too spoilery, but it does correct some of that. But I think it's there are problems with it. we'd agree it's a good show, right? It's a well-written show and well-produced and, you know, put together.
I can't side one way or t'other on a pilot. I'm gonna need to watch the full. Crack on with the first series before I have any kind of fault. I'm still at that point where I don't want to like get in any way emotionally invested with anyone, because they could turn around and end up, you know, being a knobhead or something.
So your problem, because Stacey's like, I will die for this man after the pilot. Mm. And your problem, your
I
problem.
Continue to.
You're cannonballing in, and Chris is like, Chris is tiptoeing in.
And Chris, but yeah. your problem is that it's too easy a figure to like.
It's too easy to like him.
They've presented him as like so they lay the breadcrumbs, don't they? With the falling over on the bike, and they're sort of painting him as maybe a Boris Johnson-y type of character at this point, you know, someone who is I'm sorry, but But like, but you're supposed to like sigh, roll your eyes at this character. Oh, it's going to be a buffoon that everyone's going to end up clearing up after. That's what they're kind of laying the groundwork for.
Oh, that's Josh Lyman.
That's interesting. I'd never even thought of it that way. That's interesting. Yeah,
and then. And then you get so it's like everything's chaos, but the president is obviously notably absent for a lot of the pilot, which made it feel very piloty.
Yeah,
in a way, because you can only do that unveiling once, and they're really milking it. They're going
to
give
and they're setting it up. They're setting up for him to show up.
But like you can't unveil the president like that on every episode. And every episode, actually, in reality, it's just like 10 minutes at the end, but you know we've got to spend. Yeah, so they don't. So it feels a little bit like it feels a little bit like theatery, where it's and now our main event is the name
that's
that you
the thing
recognize.
Is that he wasn't supposed to be the main event, like Drew was saying. He wasn't supposed to be a regular person. We were supposed to be following
like
Josh, Sam, CJ, and Toby, and all of them.
Yeah, he just shows up to clean up the mess, and then he's like, I'm done, I'm moving on.
This is a bit of a side thing, but interesting. So Martin Sheen is Hispanic, right?
Okay.
He changed his name in order to get work back in the time when he started acting, but he isn't a Hispanic actor, but he's playing a white president, which I think is another... is that them going, no, we can't, no, ridiculous, you can't have a Hispanic president, ridiculous idea.
Can I do something different?
I was wondering based on the length of the NVR, how, you know, what about the president, you know, how, like, that obviously is to be determined how much the president features in, obviously, from your point of view.
Yeah.
No, I've completely forgot what I was going to say.
So your problems with the president, like Sorkin setting up these straw man arguments for this like daddy figure to come in and win, essentially.
Exactly. So it felt a little bit like they were just pouring it on a bit. But again, a lot of this has aged in a particular hindsight, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Like I'm getting flashbacks watching it of Clinton, really, you know?
Yeah, like earlier when we were talking about which president is he, I think he's non and an amalgam, right? Like, you know, a bit FDR, a bit Clinton, a bit, you know, whoever.
He's got a bit more gravitas than Clinton.
Well, but he's, I don't think he's any in particular. I don't think he's any president in
particular. No.
And I agree with Stacey, he's the most alike, both in terms of personality and in terms of like what they actually get done, is probably Obama.
And a president that wasn't even president until way after the show ended.
That is fascinating to think that, again, with the lens of hindsight, that that West Wing may have shaped some of the attitudes of people in the White House than vice versa.
Yeah. I mean, there is definitely some FDR stuff in there, which will come out later. I don't want to give spoilers. But yeah, so for you, the president figure in the pilot, it's too easy. Like you're meant to like him, and it's virtually impossible not to, and that's what you're objecting to. But what about the staff? You said you don't really like the Stacey will back up on this.
They're a bit.
I love Josh and I love Toby and I like the others to some extent. Gosh,
Toby was like my number one in the pilot. I was like, that man, I freaking love him, because he's the guy who plays him. He's always been one of my favorite actors. Like, that man in The Good Doctor is fantastic.
Oh, I've not seen that.
And, it's really I'll add it to the list for you. But Toby, because he's very kind of like, he's like, he comes off like he's being quiet, but when he does talk, it's very pointed and it's very like, this is what needs to be done. This is what's happening.
I think with Toby, you get the sense that he's got this righteous indignation just bubbling. I think he's the most morally centered character, and he's got this righteous indignation bubbling under the surface. And even in the pilot, you see that when he's talking to Josh and he's like, no, please go on the show. And then he breaks and it's like, because you're calamitous fucking, you know, and it comes out.
But that will come up a lot more with like the tension inside of him that just kind of like pops out in the future yeah. episodes.
Is that a little bit of
how he lets it break out in terms how of he lets it just come out.
Do you think that could possibly be like a surrogate audience point of view? The thing that you're yelling at the
No, I don't think so. No, I think with Toby, it's Toby is the one. I mean, I guess maybe he's the one who always wants to do the right thing, regardless of the cost. And then Josh right. is the one whose job it is to. He's the real politic dude. He's the one who's, you know, like strategizing, and you know, we'll make sacrifices in order for blah 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 blah. But and those two together, I love both of them, and you know, it's who you identify with, who you would want to be, right? I love Toby the most, but I would want Josh's job because that seems like the most fun.
That's gonna be quite interesting. I think how that fleshes out over season one could be really good.
But I would say a lot of the things that you're having problems with, I think, are characteristic of the way Sorkin does things, and it's going to be interesting to see how you cope with that going forward, because there is a lot of setting up arguments so that you can win them.
And also wisecracking was just laid on just quite thick. It's a superficial thing I could probably look past, but like everyone's just so snapback, you know,
and sassy. Yeah,
sassy, great word. Yes.
Smartest.
That feels a little bit stylistic of the times as well.
Yeah,
so
that's
I don't,
very much of the time. Yeah,
it felt like it was a real snapshot. Even the soundtrack being like, I mean, I've seen Robert Redford films with very similar stuff in the early 90s, but with a little bit more saxophone. And the saxophone, while still there, fades out a little bit as the by when it comes to that kind of like, it's like glamorous American type of like, you know, if you want to portray something in a positive light, there's that kind of 90s.
Well, it's American patriotic music is always marches, right? It's marches. It's got that fit. It's militaristic.
Mm-hmm. With the West Wing, it was very much the. I mean, there's still saxophone there, like that.
I don't know. I don't know if it's a saxophone. I don't. Is it? I'm not good with instruments.
Can it be clarinet? Maybe.
I think it's more. It's got the. I mean, a lot of the American political aesthetic still relies on like symbology of the Revolutionary War, right? You know, the drums, the drum lines, and the fifes, right? The pipe things. I think I hear a lot of that.
I'm thinking more of the like the yeah, but I'm of I mean, there's a lot of it, and it's also through a lot of the dialogue.
What do you mean in the dialogue?
Like, there's a lot of music over the dialogue.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember whether that's. I mean, again, it's of that era where it's got an actual. I don't know whether it's like a real orchestra, but it's got that like orchestrated like soundtrack, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know if that carries through as strongly. It's got those little sort of signature bits between scenes, which sets, you know, emotionally prepares you. This is going to be a whimsical scene, or this is a serious scene. You know, it's got that going on. But I don't think it's as forceful as it is in the pilot. I hadn't noticed till you mentioned, but it is very forceful. The musical stuff in the pilot is very
But like you say, I don't know. This could it could soften over the pilot. The pilot. It's putting in a lot of information in a relatively short amount of time, so it's going to use every trick in the book it is to like get the audience where they need to be as soon as they can in a scene, right? Hence, heavy-handed music.
I think the next couple of episodes aren't ones that I particularly enjoy. So,
okay,
not that bad. Like, I enjoy all of The West Wing. Honestly, there's only a few episodes that I outright dislike, but they're not. It's two of my least favorites, I would say, before it gets into more interesting stuff. I think it's at its best when it's the most procedural, when it's dealing with anytime it's about the president dealing with very big issues. It's at its least interesting when it's the staff trying to work out how to get something relatively small. I say relatively small. It's on a big scale because it's the White House, but trying to work out how to get something when there's an episode that's about a particular vote and trying to like wrangle everybody to vote their way, kind of thing. And that's the kind of episode I enjoy the most. I think
nice. Okay, that'd be interesting. Yeah, I I did get a little bit of American but the thick of it vibes.
But the thick of it is way more cynical.
Oh yeah, way more cynical, way more vicious, way more dark.
True.
Oh yeah. Like this is like the thick of it that you could watch in the daytime type of thing, but in America.
So people who've worked in the White House and worked in the West Wing and stuff, they often say like, oh, the West Wing is like very accurate. And I think that's partly true. I think Sorkin gets right, like how stuff works, you know, how the Senate relates to the White House, to the presidency, like how these things relate to each other. I think he gets that stuff right. But it's the most idealized view of that, right? Whereas I've watched other shows. I tried to watch Madam Secretary, and it's like, I'm not American. I don't know that much about American politics, but I know enough to know that it doesn't work like that. like so many political shows get that stuff wrong. I think in terms of how it really is, I think the thick of it is probably the most accurate. But then Armando Iannucci went on to write Veep, which has got an equally kind of cynical take.
I'm not familiar with Veep.
I just saw Stacey's.
It's Julia Dreyfus, right?
Yeah.
Julia.
Your mouth.
Oh, when you said in the thick of it, I was like, ah, Pierre Capaldi. Freaking love that show.
Oh, the thick of it.
Oh my god, yeah, because I remember you not knowing who Peter Capaldi was before when he got cast for Doctor Who, so you ended up watching all of the thick of it.
I ended up watching the thick of it and I was like, he's amazing.
I love
it. Really nice.
Have you watched the movie? The thick of it?
Yes.
What's it called? I can't remember what it's called.
In the loop, through
the loop, yeah, like, which is essentially about the run up to the second Gulf War, right, and the fabrication of evidence to justify
it. A really nice man.
oh wow! Break it out.
It was really funny. Yeah.
But yeah, I'm not sure. I was going to say I'm not sure America could take a show that's as cynical as The Thick of It, but then there is Veep, which is, you know, the American version of The Thick of It, but I don't think it is quite as, it doesn't make the politicians look quite as incompetent as The Thick of It does.
No.
I don't know, that's an interesting thought. I think everyone's a lot more cynical nowadays than they were in 99.
Some very big things have changed since The West Wing started. They address this, you know, at 9/11 happens during the run of The West Wing, and the show actually changes tone afterwards, which is a real shame. So there's 9/11, which changed the way people look at. I think in the 90s, people were less supportive of the military in America than probably any point in their history since the 60s. But then 9/11 happened, and you got this thing about like I don't support the war, but I support the troops, which is like fucking nonsense. You can't support the troops and not support the war. The same goddamn thing. I understand the sentiment, of course, but no, you can. It's okay to not support the military. Anyway, so you got 9/11, which changed things, and then the 2008 banking crisis, and then Trump. You could not make a West Wing show now. In fact, what you could make now is House of Cards, which is like the literal mirror image of the West Wing. It's the most cynical take on,
So what did you guys think about Sam Seaborn and his dealing with Lori? He didn't know, like, that whole thing. That's one of the first impressions that we get of Sam, is that, oh shit, he went out with the call girl.
Oops.
I don't know. I'm completely not sure about what. Yeah, like with Josh and Kobe, he tries to
teach the kindergarten of the class about the White House.
That bit's genuinely enjoyable.
Making it
How much are we supposed to like this guy? This guy feels irritating.
I agree. I don't dislike him, but he does irritate me.
Are we supposed to be? Is he like? I mean, I don't know if that matters.
I think you are supposed to like him, though. I think you're supposed to. He's supposed to be a sympathetic character.
Right. Okay.
But what's your reading?
To be fair, the situation sucks. But like, to be fair, as the lady here, like, I mean, He was like the fine character. Like, yeah, Josh is cute, but also like I was like, oh my God, Rob Lowe.
He's
Because
yeah.
that
I mean,
was
Rob
Rob
Lowe
Lowe.
is an incredibly
Handsome
handsome
son of a
human
bean.
being.
And so I think like he was supposed to be the one that like everyone was like, oh, Sam, but he's so handsome. He can't be in trouble, you know?
But they, I
There's
think
oh
it's
there in
interesting
every
that
show, there's always that character. They're like, they're so sweet and they're so cute. You can't be mad at them.
can't hold on to his pager.
it's interesting that they, yeah, so he's clearly the, you know, the handsome heartthrob Hollywood actor,
Joey
but
Tribbiani.
they didn't, they could have came, like, if they'd given him the Josh role, that would have been, that would have, you know, made more sense on the surface. They made him kind of like naive, well-intentioned,
A himbo.
naive. I think that's an
Yeah,
interesting
but I
way.
can't see him as Josh, though. I can't see Rob Lowe
No,
being
I
Josh's
can't at
character
all. No, not
at
whatsoever.
all.
No. Well, Rob Lowe doesn't do anger well, and you need to do anger well to play Josh. It's interesting that so yeah, he sleeps with a sex worker, and the implication is that could be, you know, disastrous for his career. And first of all, he's the deputy communications director. I don't think it'd be that big. Can any of us name any deputy communications director from any White House?
Deputy communications
Deputy
director.
communications director. Like, I don't think it would be. It wouldn't even be a front page story if
For a minute there, I thought you were going to ask, can you name any politicians that have been caught with a sex worker? Of which I can. Jerry Springer.
Harold.
Well, in a way, like, yeah. This is just America
Ricky.
catching up with Europe, which they've done with Clinton. Finally, a presidential sex scandal, right? But I think it's also interesting that it's so the Rob Lowe character is the one that has, you know, the sex scandal in inverted commas, and Rob Lowe himself in the 80s had a sex scandal. And so I don't know how much of it is informed by that.
Probably not. I
Mean,
don't
they
think
can't have been
Sorkin would have gone
unaware,
back to
right?
the 80s on that. I mean, not unaware, but I don't think he'd be all like, well, I cast Rob Lowe as Sam Seaborn, so I might as well put him in a sex scandal. I
No,
don't
no.
think that Sorkin did that.
Yeah.
And
But
there's
he
also a
comes.
lot of people with sex
I mean,
scandals. It's
yeah.
not, you know, like
Actors.
it's not, I mean, throw a rock, really.
And he tells the granddaughter like right out loud too. He's like, "I'm having a bad day," and he just, but it actually is her. Like he right, I thought she was in the classroom, but it's actually the teacher.
Which is a good little. There's a lot of farce style humor in The West Wing, actually. That's an example of it. It's very French, was it, 18th century farce kind of feel to it. Telling the wrong person the wrong thing in the wrong room, and then rushing from room to room, and you know. Yeah. But
It's
yeah,
like he
a sex scandal
knows
in the
the
White
games
House
himself.
post-Trump, I think, would not be a big deal at all.
I mean, no.
It was a huge deal with the Clinton. The fool got impeached for it.
I think it was. I think it was a huge media deal, but I don't think it changed the people who, I think all of, you know, hyperbole, all of the people who supported Clinton before the Monica Lewinsky thing supported him afterwards. The kind of people who vote Democrat don't give a shit about that. The kind of people who vote Republican, A, they can weaponize it, and B, to an extent, they care about it. But they're voting Republican anyway, so it doesn't
To
matter.
an extent until 2016, and then they didn't give a crap about it at all.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
So
I mean,
there's that.
there was that I think it was one of the like primary debates with Trump where he literally said, you know, with cameras pointing at him in a debate situation, I could walk down Fifth Street in New York and
Down
shoot
Fifth
somebody.
Avenue
Yeah,
and shoot somebody.
shoot somebody and my supporters wouldn't care. And he was right. You know? And I kind of wish this is part of the frustration watching The West Wing. I wish, you know, these fictional characters from the 90s would realize that, like, the media stuff doesn't matter that much. If you get good stuff done, the little media things, they don't really matter that much.
I mean, that's what, yeah, but if we're talking about if the West Wing is kind of like the Clinton White House, then the media stuff did matter like a lot that
I
time.
think they may I think it only mattered to the extent that they made it matter. And like I say, like with the, you know, with the impeachment stuff, I think it mattered to the media more than it mattered to voters. People love to read about it, especially, you know, the sex scandal stuff. People love to read
I
about
think
it, but I
that's
don't
where the
think it.
conflation lies. I think people like to read about it. I don't, yeah, I but people vote on well, I mean, I think to be honest, I mean, I want to say cost of living today, if nothing else. That's pro I would say that was the biggest voter issue.
I mean, it's not like, I mean, Clinton had had, well, it was broadly known that Clinton had had, you know, sexual dalliances before, and he, you know, he got reelected a second time. In, I mean, during his 1992 campaign, it came out, his, the first sex scandal came out with the, I forget her name, but she was a hairdresser who wrote, I think one of the tabloid newspapers paid her a lot of money to sell her story, and she talked about, you know.
I think I know who you mean, but I don't want to say her name in case I get wrong person. So,
that was during his presidential campaign, right? And he got elected. Like, I don't think it matters. I think Blair and Clinton in the 90s, they were all about like message, and they really thought that like any tiny mishap in the media was like deeply devastating. And I don't think it was. I don't think it was ever as bad as they thought it was.
It's a little bit like when people say Twitter's a big deal.
Yeah,
in reality, not very few only, people.
Like, it's just a bunch. Yeah, just a bunch of people that are all in the same place talking to each other.
Like, yeah, like, well, who do you know that you speak to on a day-to-day basis that still regularly tweets? Even before Elon Musk took it over, like the number of people that I personally knew who actually posted things on Twitter, least of all interesting things. Sometimes it was just a political opinion or something that they were just farting out. But like, it was hardly anyone. It really was hardly anyone. But of course, it's who's on Twitter. Like, Twitter becomes the media bubble, right? You've got journalists that are on it, and you've got politicians that are on it. And then there are probably like people from various peripheral, you know, like, so you might have entertainers, celebrities, you know, that kind of thing, but not normal people. So it became the, like, the celebrity, you know, the celebrity media bubble.
Yeah.
So it feedbacks on itself, right? So the media make a big deal about something, so politicians then take that and learn from it, and then become more cautious next time, and the content that politicians provide feeds the media, and the media then sort of feeds the politicians. Especially with Twitter, where if you are a politician, like, you're going to be seeing a substantially more amount of media if you do use Twitter.
And I guess that's bang on, and I think what's the name, the BBC's political correspondent,
Laura
Coonsbig, who people, you know, jokingly people refer to her as the Twitter correspondent now, which I think is accurate. But it's a similar feedback loop to since pretty much all news organizations, the BBC notably, have like cut back on investigative journalism, right? So they break fewer novel stories, so what they tend to do is report on whatever the newspapers are saying. And this is in a climate of newspaper ownership, you know, shrinking and shrinking, you know, fewer and fewer and fewer people are owning all the newspapers. So essentially you've got like our state broadcaster broadcasting about what Rupert Murdoch thinks. It's like, that's the news. Yeah. It's either what's on Twitter.
Think about that. It's like, think about like how fast whatever is news becomes old news and forgotten about.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, that's what happens, right? It's just a machine to generate news for attention. And then by the time something new happens, they just have to keep.
I mean, that's a relatively,
like, how much of it actually creates change via certain outcomes?
Yeah, very little.
Exactly. Yeah. Like,
yeah. No,
it's just an attention grabber. That's all it is.
Since
just
the advent of 24-hour rolling news, it's feed the beast type stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. It's just attention's money.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that Clinton era politicians being so media surrounded by it, it's almost like the worst thing you could do is something silly on television. I think now, with in the age of social media, where most politicians have a cringe reel,
idea. There's this idea in the media that Ed Miliband lost that election because he ate a bacon sandwich wrong. You know what I mean? Which,
how do you calculate that, though?
I think those things come to symbolize, and I think this is the way it works in the public imagination as well. Things like that come to symbolize something they already believe about that person. Like, if your idea is that person is out of touch and they don't understand blah blah, then something like that can encapsulate that and become the symbol for that. But I don't think it.
Yeah, they're looking for like every reason to attach to that belief with stuff that happens. But think about it too, like, think about how in sync everybody was when TV was around and there's only a few channels on television, and now like people aren't that in sync anymore. Like, you can't make a show like MASH now. Like, you can't get that many people in sync.
No, for sure. Yeah.
Now is MASH the world record for number of people watching a TV finale or something at the same time?
I think it is. Yeah, I think.
Yes.
I have to look at, I don't know the numbers, but I think it is like the last mass NSYNC number TV show. Like,
because I'm sure more people maybe watched the Super Bowl or something. That's the most. Is that usually the most? That holds records, doesn't it?
I don't know. I don't think
not
so.
Really.
I mean, I guess the,
not really off topic.
The Super Bowl is American only, really, right? Nobody else.
Yeah.
Whereas the moon landing was, you know, people bought TVs for the moon landing. Nice. Actually, as part of my sort of general cultural preparation for doing this, I watched the live coverage.
The number of people that watched the MASH finale 35 years ago was 106 million people.
A lot of people.
And the most watched Super Bowl. I don't know.
Oh my God. Oh. Australia, I'm disappointed in you. The most watched thing on Australian television is the death and state funeral of Liz too.
Super Bowl's close. Super Bowl.
Has the coronation happened yet?
Last one was 112 million people.
This weekend.
So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, so right about the Super Bowl, Chris. I mean, in 2022, the Super Bowl is 112 million, so... Mm-hmm. But that's not like one channel. That's like multiple.
Yeah, no. I mean,
sources.
what you're talking about, like, back in the day is everybody watching the same channel at the same time.
Yeah,
and, you know,
you don't have that. Small spectrum anymore. Like, there's so many mini markets now. Like,
I mean, apart from anything else, the cultural impact of that is huge. When at school or work or whatever the next day, everybody's talking about, did you see that episode of, you know? Because that's the only time you get, you know, before, you know, VHS and DVD. That's the only chance you get to see it.
That's what I really liked about Game of Thrones. I feel like it was maybe the last show where you had that, where it was like you would talk to people in the normal world out there with the normal people.
Water cooler conversations.
The small talk and the human interaction conversations.
Well, now people do this. Now people go on online.
And I feel like last.
We can't. Part of what we're doing here is emulating that, right?
Yeah, but what do you actually want to talk about it? We're not like forcing coworkers to talk about something they don't want to talk about.
On a personal subjective level, I hate that. Like, as a compulsive binge watcher, if I decide I want to watch a show, I want to watch the entire show in the next 3 days. Like, I do not want to, like, the shows that I'm watching where I've got to wait for them, I hate it.
I like it. No,
if it's like this and I'll talk about it, I'll do it. But normally, we've been watching Curb Your Enthusiasm.
I don't like the binge watch. Because, like, take for example The Witcher, that comes out on Netflix. I really like that. You watch it in a weekend, it's fucking gone, and you forget all the bits of it as well. Like, if you watch it,
I'm a compulsive binger, but also a compulsive rewatcher. So if I enjoyed it, I can watch it five more times through.
You'll go back again and look at it when you think about it. Yeah,
I don't know. I like talking about it as the story unfolds. I guess that's the
well, we could do that with The West Wing, and so far, you hate it.
Give it a chance, Chris. It's just the pilot. It's just Mr. Pilot.
The thing is,
put all the show's pressure on Mr. Pilot.
Like, I've got a lot of criticisms of The West Wing, but like a lot of these people in The West Wing have come to represent everything that was wrong with politics at the time for me. But I still love the show.
I mean, maybe I just got to come.
I was going to say I love the show, but everything you're saying is right. Like, you're not. I don't think. I think Stacey has, you know, seen more of it. I think she'd agree, right?
Wait till we get to the finale.
yeah.
How many seasons is this show?
Seven.
Okay, seven. A little bit of a spoiler.
The finale for season one.
How can a show with that many episodes be like end well?
No, it does actually. It does. Spoilery.
Oh, so it ends.
So at some point, Sorkin leaves, right? And it's generally agreed that it becomes a weaker show after that. But some of my favorite episodes are actually in that period. But it's generally seasons, is it 4 and 5 or 5 and 6, generally agreed to be the slump. But the tail end of 6 and 7, I think they're actually some of my favorite. In fact, I would say those are my favorite episodes. That for me, they're better than the early ones.
Yes, but you also say that the newest version of the newest game in the Deus Ex series is the best one ever made.
So you're still skeptical.
Yeah. I'm not saying you're dead wrong, because it's not the worst one. Maybe. I don't know. I like them all, but whatever.
We'll just have to keep watching.
But like, that's quite a... unique. That's quite an unique, not a unique opinion, but like minority opinion.
It's been,
right?
it's been a while since I've played any of them now, so I'm not sure how much I stand by my own opinion there. But I think it's right.
It's not crazy, but it's also not
not right.
It's not what you make up a very small slice of that pie chart. not a zero. And also, by the way, I really like Invisible War, and I'm wrong on that one. So,
I think most people do. It was poorly received, but most people who enjoy Deus Ex games enjoy Invisible War. Anyway, let's not talk about Deus Ex and the West Wing thing.
Tangent.
We've gotten off topic a lot.
We have.
Yeah, I think that's fine. It's going to be interesting to see how you take it as we go on. Should we? I think just for fun, I think it's fun to like give each episode a rating.
All right, let's do a rate. Should we come up with it? Do you have like something that we can put into a league table?
We can do it. We can give it a number of electoral college votes.
Okay, great.
That doesn't work.
What about like flags or something?
Not well.
If you promise me a job, I'll vote at 10.
Well, what should our measure rating metric be?
Yeah, is it a scale? So sorry, do you say 1 to 5 electoral college votes?
Let's go 1 to 10. Let's just do 1 to 10. Let's do the
1 to 10.
It's fun to do something.
We give it. We it
makes less sense.
We give it a Wyoming electoral college for like a 1, and then like California for like a 10.
So we give it a number of states that add up to a
Give it a number of states.
I'll give this one. This one was California. No, it wasn't.
That's a big
one. It's a great pilot.
It's a Rhode Island
pilot. It's such a good introduction to the show.
It's a great rated by choosing a state.
It gets 55 like oral college.
Okay, no, this is a great idea. We're gonna give it a state based on how many electoral college votes there.
Oh, okay, right. So,
I'm gonna find us a map.
So much effort put into braiding.
It's gonna be great, Matthew.
And then somebody's going to keep a record of this. Okay, I need
a picture. We can only choose.
Okay, so
I need a picture that's both the number of electoral college votes and the name of the state.
Electoral college votes by state.
Yeah, I'll stick it.
Do you need a picture? I have a list.
I'll stick it in chat. There you go.
Hold on. Okay, so yeah, let's say the lowest number is 3. We'll pick one of the states. So I'd say, like, why don't we for a 1? Let's just do like Alaska. Like Alaska's the worst. California's the best because we have 55.
So our scale, goes,
and then like somewhere
our scale is
in the
3
middle,
to 55.
3 to 55, and there's multiple options
and
for 3.
Somewhere, yeah.
And there's like no 17.
Is, like somewhere in the middle is like. New York,
Florida,
Texas.
Oh, okay.
Man,
okay.
We don't have how many. We don't have enough states for all these episodes.
Which ones? So is MT Minnesota?
No, MT is Montana.
Montana. What is MO?
Missouri, right?
Missouri.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Really
this is not a very smooth scale. We've got like 55.
It's not a smooth scale.
Yeah, but like so California is the top. Like California great episode. And then like Alaska's the bottom.
Did you know a little fact?
I would say if we were going for the bottom, it would be like Texas or Florida, but they have a pretty good amount of electoral college votes. So
yeah, we gotta be consistent with our
California's top. Like Alaska's the bottom.
I'm going to give it a Connecticut, I think.
Okay, what's
really?
Connecticut?
7.
Connecticut. 7. Yeah, like that. Is that a middle 7. Number? Is that a middling number? Oh, they can really only be.
That's not a.
No, not from 3 to 55. That's not middling.
No.
Like you want to give it like a Georgia or Illinois?
No, because the thing is, it's like California and Texas. They just go fucking off the chart.
Yeah, those guys were really good episodes.
You got Pennsylvania, New York, Virginia,
York's
North
29.
Carolina. If you want something middling, I'm not telling you how to vote.
Which one's VA? What's VA again?
Virginia.
Virginia.
Oh right, of course. All right, maybe Virginia.
13.
Yeah. Oh, there's a lot that are less than that. I don't know. That's the thing. I'm trying, because the thing is, I think there are going to there are almost certainly going to be episodes I like more than this.
Yeah. You're going to leave yourself room.
Yeah, I feel like I've got to leave.
Okay.
I feel that a pilot is very limiting. I don't really, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll give it an Indiana.
Indiana. Where are we? Okay.
11. Okay.
Stacey.
Yeah, but see, the thing is, I liked it so much, and it was I finished the first season in like a week. I just sat here and I was like, "Let's go, click." And like, I finished it real fast. And then the second season kind of slowed down because it was making me sad. but I don't know, pilot, probably a Texas. Give it a Texas.
Maybe I can find a scale map of the Electoral College is like in a line.
So I think episode one is a very good pilot for the West Wing, but I don't think it's a particularly good West Wing episode. So judging it as a West Wing episode rather than a West Wing pilot, I'll give it an Ohio.
What's
that's 20. 20.
Okay.
Interesting. And really sorry, I gave it 13, right?
I think so.
Yes.
Virginia.
And that was Virginia, that's it.
Yeah.
I like the sliding scale.
So
yeah, I was trying to see if there was like one that has like all the states in a graph or something, so we could see
tangentially related to this. The other day I was reading about the 1920 US general election, right? And in the 1920 US general election, if you're looking at the map, like, so Texas, Arkansas, Kentucky, North Carolina, the Democrats won everything south of that, so the Democrats got the vote in the south. And the Republicans got everything else, the North and the two coasts, which is like so opposite to the way it goes now. I thought that was interesting. And also,
Did it go quickly? It's
complicated. And this is part of why. So again, in that election, the Republicans got 90% of black people who could vote voted for Republican.
Wow.
Because that's coming off the back of, you know, Lincoln was a Republican. The Republican Party was kind of the party of, you know. That didn't really change until the Southern strategy. Anyway, yeah, no, that's political wonk stuff. But yeah,
is that who was that? Was that Nixon or before Nixon?
Southern strategy was Nixon. Yeah, Taylor. Yeah, Nixon, yeah.
He said the N-word a lot.
He did. So,
here's the list.
But I think Nixon was at the tail end of the, like, you know, the post-war consensus kind of where, you know, politics was, you know, come FDR, all that stuff. Nixon, especially in terms of economic policy, was like way to the left of any Democrat now. Sanders and outliers aside. Nixon actually proposed a negative income tax on the bottom bracket.
Like a universal basic income.
Kind of, means tested universal basic income. So not universal, but yeah. Yeah.
But yeah. Fascinating. No, that's amazing.
Nixon is kind of my favorite president.
he goes so against expectations because.
I think he's come to be like the villain president, the bad one. And I don't think he was even worse than the average. I think he was actually probably better than the average. It's just he got caught, right? In terms of economic policy, he did quite a lot of lefty, or, you know, what perceived now as lefty stuff. And in terms of his, he used the N-word a lot, and he, you know, was partly responsible for Southern strategy. But, you know, he voted for the equal rights stuff. I think he's complex, and I think that's interesting. Mm. I mean, just best FDR, obviously.
Yeah. Cracking.
Sorry, I got very nerdy.
Well, that's good. I mean, you know, this, to be fair, the political stuff is kind of the thing that I expect is going to be drawing me into the West Wing. That's the thing I found most interesting about it.
Mm-hmm. And that, and there wasn't much of that in the first episode. There's going to be way more of that for you to get into.
I did like the bit with the evangelical stuff at the end. That was kind of interesting, and I think that that is where the pilot came together quite well. But and then Martin Sheen got, you know,
parachuted in.
I think parachuted
big reveal.
I think they just over-egged that pudding a little bit, really.
I mean, big reveal superhero comes in to clean up the mess and leave.
The line he comes in with is "I am the Lord your God." It's not like they didn't know what they were doing, right?
This is a very like Martin Sheen is a bit like, you're good, but you know, you very much know.
Is part of this like an uncomfortableness with like the reverence that the presidency has in America, even. Maybe up until Trump, I think in American political culture, like the office is respected, whereas you don't find that sense. Like over here, there's not, we don't give a shit.
Yeah, maybe not as respected as it once was, but during that time.
Not so much now.
Yeah, but I mean, you can't
watch the show as a 90s person again. You can't watch The West Wing without knowing. What happened?
I mean, some of that does still persist. I do think America has this idea of, you know what?
A lot of the issues that they talk about on the West Wing are still like being talked about, and it's still a whole thing now.
Of course,
like we're just watching it, and I'm like, geez, we're still fighting about this.
Which is depressing. How much does history change? Does it really change that much? No.
Stuff moves glacially slowly.
Same issues. Takes time.
That is one of the things I do. It felt a little bit like, we call it the culture wars now, but it was there then. I guess it was different language was used. Like today, everything is woke. Yesterday, they called it political correctness. You know,
it just evolves. The term, it's the same meaning. Just the term gets argued over what.
If you take an adjustment for the language of the day. It does. There are bits and pieces that strike out as
I think in terms of moving policy forward, very little has changed. You know, little things have changed. We're grateful for those, but very little has changed. In terms of the accepted battlegrounds, the culture war stuff, and that, like, yeah, very little has changed. But I do think we're in a far more polarized political landscape, or whatever you want to call it, than that's been
weaponized a lot more.
We had in the US a presidential candidate who was openly calling himself a socialist. That was unimaginable when the West Wing was made.
Well, technology is a part of that too. Like, it's technology has aided that,
but I have heard that the decades after the Second World War were the anomaly. Like, I think liberals in particular, I have this idea of, oh, we need to return to normal, we need to return to the Clinton era, we need to there's an idea that was an anomaly, and usually things are way more unstable than that, and this is actually the normal. We've returned to the normal, because if you look before World War II and around World War II, like, people in that 1920s 1920 general election in the US, there was a socialist party running, right? that was a presidential candidate for the socialist party. That 50 years after World War II was actually the anomaly. And I think that holds up, I think.
That's interesting.
It depends on what people define as normal.
Because the thing is, there are a lot of things when it comes to democracy and whatever that kind of end up turning into an arms race. And an arms race tends to be pretty destructive, and therefore... Like with the longer periods of what you think of as stability, and you might use words like some kind of like national unity or something, it might very well be the case that it's just a spirit of not wanting to rock the boat too much that lasted for just a wave that lasted longer than you really thought it would have. But like, yeah, sometimes, particularly, like, it's a little bit like a stupid person is losing an argument, so they decide to shout. Like, it feels a little bit like politics can sort of end up in that way. Because, like, that's the Donald Trump thing. He escalates. Yeah. He escalates. And he basically plays the game of chicken with whoever he's playing it with. I can escalate this more dramatically than you. And he can, because he's got no shame.
But yeah, it's like, who can be louder, and how loud can we get, and then you rock the boat too much, and then you're like, oh, okay. Like, maybe. But that was his consistent approach, you know? That's...
Well, I think that's always been a failing on the left, I think, is the right are very good at using emotionality to get people on board, and the left always tries to use facts and figures to get people on board. Like, you,
I don't want
to
be...
The emotion is necessary. Like, the difference is the right are arguing... what's the word?
Rationally.
Their case is not sincere. The left's case is generally sincere. Right. Yeah. So there's nothing wrong with using emotionality and getting people on board emotionally. I think that's something the left has got to...
That's a very moral judgment, isn't it?
How do you mean?
The thing is, well, if you're like... So, like, the underlying thesis is, like, you have to argue to the truth, whereas people arguing in bad faith can just make up any old bullshit. As long as it hits the emotional notes, they can be a very they can obfuscate the truth in all manner of ways. I'm sure there's like a, I feel like there's a witty Winston Churchill quote about how about this in some way. It's like when you've got the truth on your side, you're stuck to that narrative because you can't manipulate it, because the truth is
no. But you can find,
it's like wrestling with a, was it like wrestling with a pig in the dirt or something? Yes. You get dirty.
You can find the emotional resonance within it, right? You can find the story. You can find the emotion. You can present the emotional case, and the facts can come later. Like I think the emotional part is necessary, and the right are very good at it.
Yeah, but I think the one emotion that seems to be the most powerful is giving people a reason why they're not doing anything wrong, right? Like, people just absolutely soak up the
righteousness, like the person's
very pessimistic about humanity, though, and I think people are fundamentally like compassionate, and like if you appeal to their compassion, I think that will work.
If you yell.
I mean, you get it a lot with the climate change arguments that, like, the ones that always, like, tend to be agreed upon are the ones that don't really encourage people to actually make any hard decisions. Plastic straws or something like that, you know.
Yeah, but I think that's also a recognition of the fact that, we need to change the fundamental political structure of the entire world in order to reach quite, and anything else is pissing in the wind, right? Like that's
a big shopping list.
If only we could buy our way out of it, you know. If only we could solve climate change by paying money.
Yeah.
We got to put a price on carbon emissions.
Well, yes. Anyway, all right.
Should we wrap it up?
Yeah,
I think that's a good time too. I'm going to be interested to see how this goes, because it does kind of hit a little bit like, I suppose, the 90s was a little bit of the beginnings of political awakening. It's the, you start noticing a little, you know, a few things on the telly and all that kind of stuff. So I think, and as this goes on, I'm assuming it's going to be like a series a year or something like that. It moves forward in time, right? Mm-hmm. In response to
what's the time period that the show wraps
99 to 2006.
All right,
it obviously doesn't exist in the political reality of America at the time.
Well, that's true,
literally,
right?
But so it's, mean, yeah, but it's, it follows, like, say 9/11 has quite an impact on the show.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the thing. Like, you look back on it, not only have you got the lens of what we feel is like Obama and Trump, who were two presidents that have, you know, like, definitely made their mark, as so to speak, but also 9/11, which is like, I work with people who were born after 9/11. That's kind of crazy.
Like, isn't it weird? Yeah. That's how I always, like, every time I'm like, well, I guess how old you are. Do you remember 9/11? They're like, no. I'm like, okay.
The sad thing about that is, like, people who were young or not born, like, they don't get how much everything changed after 9/11. That's the thing. Like, it changed culture. Did. It changed, you know, art, TV shows became different in tone. It's had such a massive effect. That wasn't its biggest effect. Like, a million Iraqis dying was more important than that, but...
But just how it impacted on media.
Well, there's a lot of people, like, the, like, COVID for them will be the thing that changed, like,
COVID's one of those things.
COVID's gonna be...
We don't know what
I do. Oh man, I know a few teachers, obviously, through the course of my work and all that kind of stuff. And a few, like, the social skills of kids, like, they reckon maybe about year 8-ish. So that in numbers terms is what's year 8? Like 13? 13-year-olds? 12, 13-year-olds? They're the ones that are going to be, like, the most severely hit by the lockdowns and COVID and stuff like that. And, like, apparently they're really struggling. That others have struggled as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, that's the spot where it seems like that's when you need to be around, you know, you're socially developing mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. Is right.
There's that stuff.
There's
the socialization stuff. There's the home working stuff. People have realized, you know, we can actually work from home. There's the labor stuff, you know, the key workers and that. Like, these strikes, I don't think could have happened before the pandemic. People, you know, have now got a sympathy for the people who, you know, run shops and run railways and NHS, you know, health systems. Anyway, we're trying to wrap up.
And also, don't forget, we've got to remember the weirdest part was when they did the christening with the squirty water gun.
That was great.
That was amazing.
Use the tools you have.
We did that. That as a society was where we delved to with COVID.
Yeah.
Well, I realize we made a mistake at the beginning. We didn't say our names, so people don't know who's speaking at any given time. And I'm, the Americans might not be able to tell me and Chris apart and so on. So, next time, let's remember that.
Well, but, if we say something now, could you cut it? Could you cut it?
Yeah.
I am Drew. Hello.
I am Chris. Hello.
I am Matt. Hello.
I am Stacy. Hello.
Awesome. I'll cut that in at the beginning.
There it is.
And also leave it here as well. How about if we each pick a president and talk? We do an impression of them while talking.
What?
Nope, we're out. I'll just at the end.
Like, wait, which one would I do?
Okay.
It's in a drama class where we had to do a nursery rhyme as a presidential debate.
Wow.
I mean, and I was all, I did it off of Will Ferrell's Bush. I was like, Hickory Dickory Dock. Mouse went up the clock.
I am not a crook.
Oh, you can't take Nixon.
Nixon's Drew's.
Nixon's my boy.
But boy, don't say that.
All right, I'm going to stop. Bye-bye.
All right, cool.
Bye.
Farewell.
God bless America.
Good evening to you.